Hey friend, do you want to offer meaningful learning solutions that create behavior change, fit in the flow of work, and yield real results for your nonprofit? If yes, this is the podcast for you. Join me as I explore instructional design and leadership development best practices, as well as change management, belonging, and influence. If we haven't met yet, I'm Heather, and I've been in your shoes. I'm a learning and development consultant and founder of Skill Masters Market. Before starting my business, I led learning and leadership development initiatives for a large national nonprofit. I know what it's like to need to develop your staff quickly and effectively and to build the relationships and cut through the organizational layers to be successful. And I'm bringing all of that to you in this podcast. So block your calendar, turn off your Teams or Slack chat, and let's dive in. It's learning for good. Have you ever created a training only to realize it didn't actually have the impact you had hoped? Maybe you were trying to support your people managers and developing some new skills with them, but it seemed like as soon as the people managers went back to their jobs, they went right back to their old habits too. Or maybe you were hoping that your staff who provide direct services to whoever your quote unquote clients are, you were hoping they would do something different, maybe communicate in a different way or use a specific method or something like that. But after the training, that new behavior just didn't stick. Or maybe you were kicking off a new initiative, something completely different, like a planned giving strategy that you've never done before. And it just didn't go as well as you'd hoped, despite training your staff to implement it. If you've been there, here's what you should know. It probably isn't your training's fault. There is more to behavior change than good training. And that's why I've invited L&D expert and bestselling author Julie Dirksen to join us today to expose the real reason your training flopped. And I'll give you a hint, it's not the training. Let's dive in. It's learning for good. Julie is an acclaimed author and learning strategy consultant who brings behavioral science insights to the design of impactful learning experiences. She is the author of the best-selling book, Design for How People Learn, and her most recent book, Talk to the Elephant, Design Learning for Behavior Change. She is a learning strategy consultant with a focus on incorporating behavioral science into learning interventions. She has experience creating digital learning experiences for diverse clients ranging from Fortune 500 companies, international NGOs, technology startups, and grant-funded research initiatives. She loves brains and games and evidence-based practice. Her MS degree is in instructional systems technology from Indiana University, and she's been an adjunct faculty member at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design and as a Learning Guild Guildmaster. She's happy whenever she gets to learn something new, and you can find her online at www.usablelearning.com. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited that you're here. You are like L&D fame, right? You're a best-selling author. A lot of people have picked up your first book, Design for How People Learn, but now you have a second one that's out as well. I'm so excited for the Learning for Good audience to be able to hear from you today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It's such an interesting space, the nonprofit space and everything that they're trying to do. There's a lot of behavior change challenges in a lot of these organizations are dealing with. So,
absolutely. And that is one of the things that I found most nonprofit L&D people want. They want to create that behavior change. They want to have that impact and they want to be able to elevate themselves to be a strategic partner in the organization. And so I'm excited to talk today, not just about training, but about all of those other things that impact how successful your training can be. But before we jump in, I always like to hear in your own words, a little bit about your career journey. How did you get to where you are?
I think so many learning and development people are what the way I describe it is, hey, you're a good customer service rep. We're going to let you train the other customer service reps. You could refer to that as the accidental instructional designer or whatever term you want to use. But my story's like that. I'd done a little bit of certification to teach English as a foreign language. That was my first kind of education piece and things like that. But I was working for a company as a part-time job while I did other stuff, doing loan processing for financial applications. And they basically said, hey, you're pretty good at this. Do you want to teach it to other people? And then once I got into that, the subject matter wasn't something I was particularly passionate about, but I did really get interested in how do you design good learning experiences and how do you use technology for it. This was the 90s, so we were just scratching the surface with things like web-based training and so on. And so that's what I got really interested in. And also at the same time, I was interested in the question of, is it the system or is it the person and which one should you be fixing? So I also got interested in, we weren't even calling it user experience yet, like the UX field. We were still calling it human-computer interaction or usability engineering, depending on what your entry point was. But I got really interested in that because I do think there's always this balance between the person, but they're also operating in a system. And that there's a lot of things where we keep insisting on trying to fix the people when really we would be better off just trying to fix the system so that the people can do their thing without having to climb over a bunch of barriers to just do the thing that we wanted them to do in the first place. So I've always had that balance of viewpoints. And then some of that led to my first book, which that's the target audience is people who have a lot of knowledge in their domain and then get asked to teach it to somebody else and needing an entry level or first book for that. And so that's what my first book Designed for How People Learn was. But then as I went on, I realized there were some places where the problem wasn't knowledge. Like people knew the thing and the problem wasn't even skills. They could do the thing and they still weren't doing it. So that's what the new book is aimed at, is they know what to do, but they're still not doing it. And how do we help people with that?
Yeah, I love that. And I know a lot of people have read that first book, Designed for How People Learn. I'm sure they are super excited to hear more about your second book. So tell us a little bit about Talk to the Elephant, Design Learning for Behavior Change.
Yeah. So in the first book, I had a chapter 8 was on motivation, and I used the rider elephant metaphor for the first time, which is people sometimes credit me for that. And I'm like, no, it's Jonathan Haidt's metaphor. I just borrowed it. But it's the idea that a big swath of our brain is concerned with dealing with the physical world. So it might be sensing it, vision, hearing, it might be moving around like physical control. It might be the emotional impact of things. What do you feel about stuff? So it's this sort of visceral feeling, emotional brain, and that's the elephant. And then we've got in front, we've got things like the prefrontal cortex, which do things like executive function and impulse control and logic and reasoning. And it's the part of your brain you have a conversation with, not necessarily just that region, but the rider part of your brain that you can project out into the future and consider consequences and make decisions based on them. Almost all of the decision-making models that we really use have this idea of you've got your logical, rational thought, but you've also got your emotional, visceral entity as well. So when your alarm goes off and logically you really should get up, but you still find yourself hitting the snooze button, that's a case where your elephant, which is, it's warm and quiet and comfortable here, we should stay a little longer. Thick, your decision-making entities, the elephant kind of won that one. And so I talked about that in the first book. It was chapter 8 about motivation and things. But there was so much more to talk about. And also, I had really felt as an instructional designer, my toolkit that focused on memory and skill development and knowledge acquisition didn't move over to some of these other scenarios. I was involved on a project several years ago that was an AIDS and HIV prevention project, and everybody in our target audience knew that condom usage was important for HIV prevention. And so if they still weren't doing these safe sex practices that would prevent the spread of HIV, it wasn't a knowledge problem. Telling them louder and more emphatically to do it wasn't going to change the behavior. So what other tools should we really have in our toolkit when we come into some of these difficult behavior change challenges?
Yeah, I always say knowledge doesn't equal behavior change, because if it did, I would do my laundry on a regular basis, right? I know if I don't do my laundry every day, after a couple of days, I'm questioning how many people live in my house, right? Like, where did all this laundry come from? I don't know. I know that logically, yet when it comes to actually putting laundry in every day and getting the laundry out and folding it and putting it away, it just doesn't happen. Knowledge does not equal behavior change. And I love the example that you shared. Yelling doesn't help, right? It doesn't help to keep telling people, but that's not the reason that behavior hasn't changed. So we talk a lot about behavior change and training, and a lot of times training does get the blame when the behavior hasn't changed. So tell me in your experience, with your expertise, why does training flop?
Yeah, well, training often gets asked to hold the bag for a lot of things that it really shouldn't be responsible for. So anytime a large organization has a big epic fail, one of the first things, like the CEO, when they're doing their apology message out to the world, is we're going to do training. And it's always worth asking, well, was an absence of training really the thing that led to this big epic fail? Or what other systems were in place that maybe allowed this to happen? I was talking to, I've done some work with NGOs in terms of international healthcare stuff. And I was talking to somebody who, you know, deals a lot with training healthcare workers. And she was saying to me, they don't take any initiative. It's really frustrating. They don't take any initiative. And I'm like, you live in a world that is all about compliance. What about doubling down on compliance for all of these things? Do you think would lead somebody to believe that taking initiative is something that they should do? And I thought her head was going to explode. She just gave me this look of, oh, okay, we've got a system where we've been leaning, and for good reason. We care about compliance in healthcare because we're trying to remove error from the system so that, because when errors happen, bad things happen. People die, right, in healthcare systems when errors happen. But at the same time, that heavy emphasis on a compliance-focused system where we're trying to remove error and get people to do it this way with very clear guidelines and spelled out, that is not an environment that's going to foster an attitude of initiative and self-starting and, you know, all those kinds of things. And it's not that it can't, but if you optimize a system for one thing, you shouldn't be surprised when the other thing doesn't show up. But yeah, it's a really common thing too, where training, we don't know how to fix this because it's big and it's hard. And so we'll do training. Every person who's ever gotten handed those training tasks knows perfectly well that there's other stuff that are going on. Our manager's going to reinforce this. Is there going to be support for people after they're done? Are they going to be given time to do this lovely thing that we're teaching them in this training class? Is there going to be any kind of accountability? Are people going to be even required to come to the training class? Or all of these factors that are going to influence whether or not the initiative is successful. And that in the absence of some of these other things that are involved, it's probably not going to change much. So,
yeah, I love that you're bringing in all of the external factors, the things outside of the training that impact whether the training is successful, whether the initiative succeeds. So how can we take more of a system view in learning and development, knowing that there are all these other things that are happening, all these other factors that impact the success of the training, so to speak? How can we take a systems view?
Yeah. One of the systems questions that I always look at whenever we're dealing with some of these things, and there's a lot of factors that come into play, but one of the really big questions is, pretty much every behavior change problem that I have ever seen has delayed or absent feedback as a kind of root cause element. So if we think about the behaviors that we struggle with as humans, so maybe it's eating healthy, maybe it's exercising, maybe it's wearing sunscreen, maybe it's saving for retirement, any of these kinds of things. If you say, if I don't do this today, what's the consequence that happens, right? And you were describing this with your laundry situation. Like, you can get away for a day, you can get away for 2 days, you can get away for 3 days, and then it starts to get ugly. And so you've got this sort of delay in the consequence of it. There's still enough clothes in the household for at least 3 or 4 days before we start not having the things we need. And so it can kind of keep pushing that one down. And so the consequences will show up, and they'll show up fairly quickly within a few days, but they're not going to show up immediately. If I don't save for retirement, we all know intellectually there's a real bad thing that is waiting for us if we don't save for retirement. But if I don't save anything for retirement this month, nothing really bad is going to happen. No, there's going to be no significant change in my world because I didn't save for retirement this month. If I don't wear sunscreen, I might get sunburn, but a lot of the sun damage is UVB rays, and those aren't really the things that cause sunburn. And so you can still get sun damage even if you're not getting burned. And so, yeah, I know I should wear it more often, and I try to make sure that it's in the moisturizer that I use and all that kind of stuff, but it's still, nothing really bad happens. There's no immediate consequence for this. And so when we look at this at the system level, one of the questions to ask is, if people are trying to change their behavior, will they see some kind of feedback at the individual level? So for example, in a company where I sell things, if I do a sales training, I will know per salesperson whether they sold more widgets or didn't sell more widgets. But a lot of other things, we don't have that kind of really concrete metric that we're dealing with. So if we think about something like hand washing, which is a huge issue in healthcare, and we're all very aware of it because we just had a pandemic and everybody was probably at the top of their hand washing game for about 10 minutes there. If we look at hand washing, if I have stuff on my hands, I'll wash them. I don't think we have a big behavior change when people's hands are visibly dirty. I think they mostly wash them. Maybe there's some exceptions if they're incredibly busy, but mostly they do. But it's the, I've washed my hands 9 times in the last 6 minutes and I've got to wash them again because I picked up some stuff and I'm trying to treat a patient and I really should wash them. But my hand isn't going to look any different after I wash it. So I don't get any kind of visual feedback showing me that I changed something. If I don't wash it, I could potentially spread disease, but the likelihood that I'll ever be able to connect me not washing my hand at 3 o'clock on Thursday to a particular patient getting sick is almost non-existent. And at a certain point, I can't really see that there's an impact to hand washing behaviors until we're dealing with maybe the group level. There's an infection on the ward or the system level in that our hospital system has a higher infection rate than other hospital systems. And so since there's no feedback at the individual level, not really, nothing changes for me. We're relying entirely on intellectual knowledge because the rider is the one who knows things about things like germ theory and the elephant's like, I don't know, it looks okay. I think it's probably fine. So when we have those, that's where we start to see that issue. And then where can you see the impact of it? I have an example in the book where I was talking about gender equity and salary offers. And if the manager is deliberately offering an inequitable salary offer, they know that. But I think mostly that's not what's happening. I think mostly, well, it seems like a fair offer based on their experience, based on all these intangibles and all these kinds of things. And in that kind of squishy space, that's where some of these inequities start to be an issue. But we can't really tell until I take that person and compare it to 5 other jobs of the same jobs. So really, you really don't know that a salary offer is inequitable until you've compared it against 5 other people. And if you don't have that group to compare it to, that's a problem. But also, we don't like to talk about salaries. Managers don't always know what other people in the organization are getting paid for similar kinds of things. They may or may not. We hide a lot of that information as a matter of tradition for a whole bunch of complicated reasons. But it means that you can send that manager to a nice DEI training that says you should treat everybody equitably. And yet when they try to do it, they may still be missing because they don't have this crucial piece of information that they would need in order to know if they're doing this right at an individual level. And so maybe it doesn't show up until we're at a system level and we're starting to see, hey, there's inequities in these salaries that can't be explained by anything other than race or gender or national origin or any of the other kind of protected classes. And so when those are the case, when you can't see the impact of a behavior unless you're looking at a group or system level, that is going to be a tough behavior to change by training the individual. I'd say tough, possibly, just you're not going to because they just don't have enough information. And so then you start to have to really look at it at a system level and go, okay, what needs to exist in order for the feedback to work in a way that we can effectively do it? In the book, I describe how Salesforce.com has spent something like, I don't know, $12 or $15 million, like working on this problem, correcting pay disparities. And they've had to like really set up a system of metrics in order so that they can do that apples to apples comparison across different roles and all of these kinds of things. It doesn't just happen because we did some nice training. It happens because we look at the whole system and try to figure out what do we need to fix in order to support the behavior that we're looking for.
Do you wish you could connect with other nonprofit learning and development leaders? I know what it feels like to want someone to bounce ideas off of and to learn from, someone who really understands you and your work. Imagine if you could have a simple way to meet people in the field, ask questions, and share information. That's why I created the Nonprofit Learning and Development Collective, where nonprofit, L&D, talent management, and DEI leaders can connect with each other quickly and easily in a virtual space. When you join this community, you will walk away with a new, diverse, and powerful network and a sounding board for your staff development needs. So if you're ready to exchange ideas and collaborate with your peers, come join the Nonprofit L&D Collective. Yeah, I love that you gave the gender equity example with, hey, when we first started talking about why training flops and systems and things like that, DEI training is one of the first things that came to mind for me. If something isn't going right, it's easy to say, well, we'll train them, but the training might not have been the answer to begin with. So I love that you gave that example. It really did illustrate like there's more to it than just training. And Salesforce may or may not have had a training as an example, right, on pay equity, but they also did all of these other things and invested a lot of time and resources in order to fix the challenge that they were having with pay equity rather than just let's send them through a training.
One of the organizations in the US that's typically had the lowest level of, and even they're not immune to it, but has had the lowest level of pay inequity is the US Postal Service, because it has such clear prescribed rules for what people get paid. It's based on seniority and job role and all of these kinds of things. And so there's very little like managerial judgment that's impacting kind of how these things happen. And so I'm sure there's cons to that system. I'm sure it's not a perfect system for a whole bunch of reasons, but it did mean that if the problem is so embedded in the system, there's really no way that training an individual is going to basically undo all of the systemic stuff that's set up to reinforce it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So knowing that most of the people who listen to this podcast, they are creating training inside of nonprofits, they might fit in an HR role, they might fit in a talent development role. So depending on where they fit in the organization, they're going to have different insight into the system, different ability to impact those systems. Sometimes we even have people who sit in kind of a program or operations role, but they're responsible for training some folks in the organization. So knowing all of that, what's one thing that someone who's listening to this podcast right now can do immediately to help their next training be more successful?
Yeah, a lot of it is trying to meet people where they are with the support that they need. I have a little tool in the book that is this kind of change ladder, and I've got it out on my website as a giveaway if people want it. But it looks at the question of, is the issue that they don't know about the behavior at all? So for example, it might be about the person in the organization who's managing the website has never heard of alt text and doesn't know that you should do that to improve the accessibility of your website. Great. Training is going to fix that just fine. You do the class. Or at least we hope a training will fix it. But training will fix the fact that they don't know about it. And they can take a class on how to do alt text and great, on how to put it in the website. Fantastic. But then you have situations where maybe they do know about the behavior, but it just doesn't seem like it's a big priority. I've certainly heard lots of stuff from people about, oh, do we need alt text? Because nobody in our audience can be visually impaired because they're drivers, right? Literally, we can't have visually impaired people in the audience. Well, there may be other people who need to access this training or participate in it or whatever. That's not a great reason for not supporting accessibility, but at least that's a conversation we can have. I won't tell you it's really important. I might have a conversation about why, even if your main audience doesn't need it, it's still a good thing to do. Or they might understand the explanation, but they're just still not convinced. And then you get into things like, what are the kinds of persuasion? Do I need to show you that this is becoming the industry standard and that you're falling behind? Do I need to use a social norming kind of approach? Or do I need to figure out how to make this easy for you? Or what other things can we do? Then you're convinced, okay, I want to do this, but I don't know exactly how to get started, or I'm not confident that I'm doing a good job about it. Well, then you need maybe coaching or some kind of performance support or something like that. And maybe I did it for a while and now I'm falling off of the habit. And so I need something to help me reinforce, whether it's some sort of feedback system or whether it's a contract with the other person that will double check each other's work, or some kind of social obligation or accountability situation, or maybe I need some method of tracking it, or my manager needs to support me. So as people move through these kind of continuums, and it's not like they're going to stop at every single spot on the list, but we are going to generally move through a series of steps, trying to find out where your learners are and meet them with the right kind of support at that. And not just assume that if I just tell you about this in greater detail, in ever greater detail, that's going to be the thing that you need in order to be able to act on this.
Exactly. It all goes back to yelling doesn't help. Right. I feel like that's the tagline, right? Yelling doesn't help. No, this was so, so good. Meet them where they are. Sometimes they need to learn something. Sometimes they need to be convinced. Sometimes they just need to build their confidence to do the thing. And sometimes the new habit, the new behavior needs to get reinforced. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And it's a great way to think about the learning from an L&D perspective, and where are they, and how can we meet them in that spot to move mm-hmm. them along that change ladder? Julie, thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been very fun. Hopefully it's of use to your audience. So
yeah, absolutely. This was great. It was a great conversation. I know that so many people in learning and development are really trying to think about impact and behavior change and how do we get there? How do we prove it? How do we make it happen? And thinking beyond the training is a great approach. So I'm so glad you were able to join and share more about talking to the elephant and about systems and how we can be more successful in L&D.
Yeah, one of the sort of things I think it's always useful to remember is that there's always a reason why people are acting the way that they're acting, right? There's always something. It may not be a reason that we love, or it may not be an ideal reason, but if we pretend that they're just being stubborn, or they're just not listening, or something like that, and if we're not looking at the system around them and going, okay, what's reinforcing this behavior? What's either reinforcing the behavior we don't want, and how does that compare to us reinforcing the behavior we do want? So looking at all of these factors is super important for these challenging behavior change. Some things are fixed by a little bit of education, but there's other stuff that we're all dealing with that is a little bit more difficult. And so unpacking and trying to understand where your learners are at and what they care about and what pain points they have, I think is incredibly important and always worth the effort. So
always worth the effort. We have to be change detectives sometimes and more than just training creators. Well, Julie, thank you again for joining today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So glad Julie was able to join today and talk about the systems and the external factors that impact whether or not our training is successful. Here's my big takeaway from today. We have to be change detectives in L&D. What do I mean by that? We have to ask good questions and know our audience. What would prevent someone from making the change that we want to see? Do they not know they need to make the change? Do they not know how to make the change? Are they not motivated to make the change? Or maybe they're scared to make the change, uncomfortable. Are they held accountable when making the change? Can they see the impact of the change? We have to ask good questions. We have to be change detectives. And then, and only then, can we meet them where they are and provide the right solution to create that behavior change. I'd love to hear from you. When you put on your change detective hat, what is the biggest barrier to behavior change in your nonprofit? Head over to the nonprofit L&D Collective private community just for people like you who are creating training inside of nonprofits, and share what is the biggest barrier to behavior change in your nonprofit. I want your colleagues from nonprofits all over the world to weigh in on this discussion and let us all help each other be better change detectives. I'll see you there. Until next time, on Learning for Good.
Hey friend, was this episode helpful for you? Did you like what you heard? Do you want more content like this? Here are three things you can do. Hit subscribe, leave a review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast app of choice. Share this episode with a colleague. This means so much to me personally. I read every review, but it also helps me learn what content you like most so I can create more of what you want. All right. Turn that Teams or Slack chat back on when you're ready, and I'll see you next time on Learning for Good.